From me, we'll turn the meeting over to Jerry, our chairman for the month of January. All yours, Jerry.
Thank you, Marty. Surrender, surrender, surrender. Don't drink. Go to meetings. The answer to all your problems. Blessed today. Tonight my lead is a very good friend of mine. I was just thinking of the leads and it's equal opportunity destruction. No prejudice. Anybody's welcome into this group. And my lead tonight is a very good friend of mine. And he's name is Larry Van Dusen, and his home group is Berea Men's Group. And I know that if you listen, you'll hear something that's useful. And if it doesn't ring a bell, put it on the shelf, as Poutney used to say. And I'm sure you, someday you'll be able to use it. Thank you. Larry?
Thanks, Chair. Appreciate it, sir.
And there's a third one here.
My name is Larry Van Dusen. I'm an alcoholic. Those that care to, you join me in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I appreciate having the invitation to come over and share with you tonight. Being able to do that, whatever the meeting is, whatever the occasion is, I think that's one of the benefits of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it's one of the necessities to share when we can with others, be it a big group, medium group, or small group, sitting in the parking lot, you know, in a meeting and before a meeting, after a meeting, trying to reach out to somebody else to pass on to them what's been given to us. Whether it's our first week, our first year, or whatever it happens to be. That's part of my understanding. Last drink I've had up to the moment was approximately, as I can remember, about 10 o'clock in the morning on November 11th of 1975 up in Madison, Wisconsin. And that's the day a guy picked me up and took me for a ride down to a small town about a half hour away called Stoughton, Wisconsin. And I met with a guy, a person who was the director of a rehab place. I didn't know why I was going, what it was going to be about, and he decided he wanted to keep me, and I haven't had a drink since. And so after being in the program and after coming down to Cleveland, I was about 6 months sober, that's when I got into our meetings around here, and I heard things like sponsorship and home groups. Now, maybe I heard that in Wisconsin, I don't know, but maybe I was just too new to understand. And so once I understood about a home group, I got my myself a home group, and I've had one ever since. And once I understood about a sponsor, there was a fellow in the area that my understanding of a sponsor was to, you know, work with somebody smarter than you in AA. Well, when I was here, I looked around, everybody's smarter than me. Okay? But you have to be willing to admit that. Okay? Some of us aren't willing to admit that. One of our West Side guys that knows a lot of people here, Harold Jacobson, was my first sponsor. And I remember asking him, it was at the midnight meeting over in Puritas. So by the time after the meeting, it had to be about 1:30 a.m. And I asked Harold to be my sponsor, and he was my sponsor the day he died. And the day they had the service and the reception down at Stella's, a fellow in the car was riding with me by the name of Eddie Dorr. And I, from our Berea area, and Eddie had started Berea Men's, my home group, and so I asked Eddie to be my sponsor, and the day he passed away, he had 52 years in our program, uninterrupted sobriety, which meant then I needed to have another sponsor because I believe in the concept of sponsorship. And so there's another area, another fellow in our area, very active. Used to run with a lot of the old-timers and Gus Patakis and Ted Rusnicks and people like that, and the name of Kenny. And I asked Kenny if he'd be my sponsor, and he said yes. And Kenny and I and my wife had dinner last night. I try to be in touch with him every week, whether we just talk or whether we meet at meetings, but I take it upon myself to make the contact with my sponsor. On occasion, he'll do that with me, but I look at it as my responsibility to make the connection. And I ask him to be the sponsor, so I need to keep in touch with him. And what I find with the sponsorship, just real simple, as long as I'm talking about it, is two things that became important. One was I had somebody in my life that I could totally trust. Totally trust. My early years, wasn't anybody like that, because you see, I'm not trustworthy, so why would I trust you? And then after getting sober for a while and starting to learn about that. And then the second factor was confidentiality. When I shared things with any of my sponsors, which I'd done many times, I never had to qualify it by saying, listen, I'm going to tell you something that I don't want you to tell anybody else. That just has never come up. And so when I share something with Ken or with Harold or with Ed, I'm never concerned about going beyond that source. And I hope the guys that I sponsor have that same understanding with me. But those are some of my basics. As I look at my life today, everything that's in my life today is because of sobriety, recovery, God of my understanding, and a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was at my bottom, and I destroying everything in my life, and I'll touch a little bit on that, doing it Larry's way, which didn't work, and hating and resenting everybody, and drinking over it, I was on a downhill slide. Once I was introduced to the program and the people, you gave me a whole new way of life. I've adopted that. I don't have any second, third, or fourth program that I feed into that. That's allowed my whole life to change. And so I can look back on everything that's in my life today. It's got a whole other relationship to in a positive way because of not drinking, because of the quality of sobriety, a program of recovery called Alcoholics Anonymous, and all those steps and principles and a God of my understanding. Now, that's very clear to me. I'm not looking for something else, another way to live. And I've got good books, and I've got big books, and I've got our literature, and that's my guideline. And so far, it's worked. And I'm not taking a vacation from something that allowed me a vacation, and I'm not going to retire from something that allowed me retirement. I was in the athletic business, the football business, for 41 years. And I know this, there's a theme. Don't underestimate your opponent. If you do, you're liable to get whipped. And I spent years underestimating alcohol. And it beat me time and time and time and time again, and I never even identified it as the enemy or the opponent at the time. Everybody else was the opponent. The wife, the authorities, the doctor, the in-laws, the outlaws, all that. They're the opponent. And alcohol was the teammate that I put in my system to give me the strength, to give me the wisdom, to give me the courage, to give me the whatever to go ahead and deal with that. And I misjudged it. And I lost. But the guy said to me, I had a long losing streak when I came here. The guy told me one time, you know, Larry, if a team beats you all the time, every time you play them, like around here, like Pittsburgh and the Browns. Just recently, not in the old days. But he said, you know, if you had an opponent that beat you all the time, you know what to do about it? And I was looking for his wisdom. What do you do? He says, get them off the schedule. You don't play them, and they don't beat you. Now think of the wisdom of that. See? And so that's not a loss. And when I finally figured out he's talking about alcohol and getting them off the schedule meant don't drink. If I don't drink, I at least got a chance. And that's what they told me. I have a chance to recover. And others have done it if I'm willing to do what they've done. And so as I look at my life, you know, I was 6 months sober. Somebody offered me a job over in Berea, Ohio. And he took a chance on me. And 28 years later, I finally retired. And in that process of life and events, like they say, the pieces of life will come back together, not necessarily original pieces. And so my first wife never came back, but I met a lady in the program, Marilyn, and some knew her, and she was just a dynamite lady, along with being a great AA. And unfortunately, after 10 years, cancer took her out of our life. And then another lady I met going back to a high school reunion, and we married, and it's been 18 years later. She knows nothing about AA. As a matter of fact, AA's overwhelmed her in the beginning. She didn't understand who we were or what we're like. And we'd go places, and they'd grab her and hug her and shake her. She'd a little bit. What are these people doing? See? I'll tell you something that caught her eye one day, though. Just before we got married, her dad died in South Bend, Indiana. About 3.5 hours from Cleveland. And I'm down there for a visitation. Like I say, we're engaged, we're not married. And all of a sudden, through the door came three or four AAs that drove down from the Cleveland area all the way down there, found that funeral home, came into that funeral home, walked over to her, walked over to me, and the relatives are saying, "Who's that?" And they came down to pay their respect. She said, "Well, why would they do that?" And about the best I can do is that's what AAs do. They're concerned about others. They're there about a half hour, and they go back and get in the car and drive another 3-4 hours home. Now, a lot of people would not do that. They knew nobody except me and had met Barbara. But out of their love and concern and habits, they executed. And they came down, they had their meeting down, they had the visitation, the meeting back. And all those guys are sober to this day. Isn't that interesting? And so that exposure to us was a whole new way of life. But you know, we have a house that's paid for, we got a couple of cars. I've never been a money guy, so don't let me give the impression. It's just, you know, going to work and doing what you're supposed to do and saving what you can and paying when you can. And all of a sudden, I've got two daughters and a son, and my wife has two daughters and their husband. We got 11 grandchildren, you know, and I'm grandpa to all of them. We don't separate his and hers and ours. And I'm a sober grandpa. A good friend of mine said in a meeting one time, you know, the terms grandpa and badass just don't go together. And I found that so true, so true. And, you know, on Friday, I was 71. I had continued to be 71 years old. On Saturday, I became 72. I never figured out how you can live day by day, and all of a sudden, after midnight, a year went by. But when I got home and answered the phone, I had one of those little soft voices. "Grandpa, happy birthday. I love you." Say, click. Now, what do you have to do to earn that? See? So just one of those little reward things. As a drunk, I don't get that call. But the thing just doesn't happen. So it's very clear to me what was wrong, who was wrong, and what to do about it. And I've just been trying to do what others have done. I don't have original thinking or great philosophy. I just try to follow those that have been going ahead, just like our book says. They seldom see the person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. I've been trying to follow the path. I am not one that's trying to come up with a new path or a shortcut, because that doesn't work. I remember watching a World War II movie one time. I think it was with Clint Eastwood. I'm just watching the war movie. And the guys come up, and there's a minefield. And you know Clint's going to get across. So he's marking it, and he gets to the other side, and he looks back and says, "You know, just step in my steps and follow me across, and you'll be okay." And I'm thinking, chapter 5, first sentence. The first guy gets across, second guy gets across, third guy gets... The fourth guy, he's got his own agenda, goes for a shortcut. Boom! He doesn't make it. And to me, that was the program in action through watching a war movie, for crying out loud. They ask us to follow the path. There's already been a lot of bodies along the way. Some were buried sober and some were not buried sober. They just were buried. And so I can either stay on the path and go to the far end of it, Like a guy told me one time, he says, this is a marathon, Larry. This isn't some short sprint. You're in here for the long haul. This race goes on a daily basis. And so that's the preparation for that. See, me not knowing any of that, me not knowing anything about alcohol, alcoholism, it wasn't in my family. It wasn't in, maybe there were people around me. I didn't notice that at the time. I just growing up. And so once I left home, I never had a problem. I knew what my mom and dad's rules were. You did this and you don't do that. And I knew what the coach's rules were. We always had training rules. You do this and you don't do that. And when I went to Sunday school, they had rules and regulations. And since a little kid, I heard what they said. You do this and you don't do that. I have never had a problem knowing the rules. However, on occasion, I've had trouble following the rules. And I know when I would violate mom's rules, the coach's rules, there are usually some kind of punishment or something that goes along with that. And so as a kid early on, I'm learning already when I violate your rules is to try not to get caught. And one of the first things I learned was lie. You know, don't admit to it. Come up with a different story. Blame somebody else. I'm just talking about as a kid. I hadn't even tasted alcohol. So I think that's instinctive with a lot of us in here, way before we started to put it down. Once I started to do that, then I had to exaggerate and I had to come up with better stories and bigger lies. It could have stopped, but I didn't think about that. And so somehow I get through the high school years and off to college, and that's when I got into the serious drinking. I had a couple of ex-teammates of mine that were older. They were men in my eyes. They were my new heroes, and they asked me to go into Chicago with them one time, and I went. I'd have gone anywhere with them, being included. And I seem to be a person that long time has always had some self-doubt, always kind of felt inferior in certain areas. And I don't know about you, but there's times I felt superior. You know, if we're on the ball field or we're on the court or we're on something that has to do with that, I'm okay. But you put me in a classroom, you put me with wealthy or smart people, and I feel, you know, way out of place. So that maturity was a long time coming. I'm not sure it's there yet. And so John and Lou asked me to go to Chicago. I did. They drank. I drank. And I like to look back as a time that I was introduced to the magic of alcohol. All of a sudden, I got the glow. I got the feeling. I got the benefits. What seemed like positive benefits from drinking. And I liked that because now I felt confident, I felt assured, I felt cool, all that stuff. And I don't know about you, but when I feel that, I'm looking to do that again. And then I want to do it again. And I have a tendency, you might find this strange, but I have a tendency when I'm drinking sometimes to overdrink. And I might go past that peak. And then I wake up in places and the people say, you did this, you said that, we're blackballing you, your car's smashed, you're flunking out, and, oh, what happened? I'm still looking for that perfect evening. You know, that evening when you went out and you were at the peak of all your qualities, maybe you got lucky that night or whatever it was that you were doing, and I wake up the next day and maybe I got a little hangover, maybe a little sickness, and I like what it was last night, but I'm not that way now. But I don't want you to know I'm not like that. I don't want you to look at me and not see who I thought I was last night. So now I got to pretend. And when I pretend, that means it's not real. And I'm a phony. And I don't want you to know I'm a phony. And so you start your swagger. You start your talk. You start your action. You start doing whatever fits your image. Look at all the disguises we bring into these rooms when we first get sober. We hide behind the clothing, we hide behind the beards, we hide behind the hair, we hide behind anything I can put on to hide behind. And when you look at me, that's what you see, but what's inside I don't want you to see. Because that's where the phony is. And after we get sober and clean up our different versions of our life and become more mature, so to speak, and get back into life and living with the qualities and principles we talk about, wow, what an adventure that is. Because now I don't have to apologize or look back at all. just get her going. And I didn't know that at the time. And so I look back in those early drinking years, and I can see negative happenings in my life, socially, academically, athletically, family-wise. I was causing difficulties, and somehow skipping by. It amazes me how some of us can stagger forward in life and look like we're advancing on one side by the world standards, and yet we're destroying ourselves on the other, the invisible side. Because in the next 5 or 6 years, I'm jumping from job to job to job up my ladder of success. I've got a goal, I've got aspirations, I've got things I want to do, and I'm getting closer to that. And if I'm working for you, I give you everything I got. You want 70 hours, you want 80 hours, you want to go 7 a.m., midnight, whatever it is, I'll go for you. And then afterwards, I go out and drink, and I go out and party, and I go out and do the X-rated stuff that I got in the habit of doing. And so I don't tell you about that. And so as I'm working up on the one side, I get there at the peak back in Chicago, and if you say to me, how you doing? I say, well, here's the wife, here's the house, here's the cars, here's the job, here's the title, here's the responsibility. It looks good. I don't tell you last night, I can't remember how I got home. I don't know how that car got smashed. I don't know how many mornings I woke up and had to interrogate my wife to find out the details of last night without her knowing that I don't know. So that I can get some idea in case I go back with people I was with and they always seem to know more about what I was doing than I did. And I heard a guy in a program, it made sense to me, never talk to somebody who knows more about what you did last night than you do, especially if they got a uniform. And I understood that right away, because I'm trying to defend myself. I went from the offense to the defense, and you got to be on guard. And people would bring up, hey, last night when you drove those guys off the road, they went in that ditch. You know, if they got out of there, we're going to be in trouble. And I'm saying, what card? What ditch? You know, I'm in a blackout. I've had blackouts since I started to drink. I didn't know that's what they were, but I had extended time. And so I don't tell you about those things. What I do is I get to a place where it seems like you're going to get caught. You remember that time when it seems like they're finally getting close enough to you, whether it's the wife, whether it's the boss, the community, whatever, they're just about ready to fall, and I move. I got a chance to come to Ohio. I came to Ohio. I got a fresh start, new beginning. Good-looking props. And we go out to a big convention in New York, and I go out and I meet a former college friend of mine, and we go out on to New York City, and I come back stumbling, falling, crawling, puking into the hotel. And the next day I wake up in my room, in my bed. That was an accomplishment. And I'm sick and I'm hungover. And I've wet myself, and I've wet that bed, and I got to get all those things squared away that you do, and try not to let my roommate, a regular adult male person, find out that I'm doing that. And you take care of that, and then going down the hall, and you see somebody, and they just shake their head at you, and you know everybody saw you. Might have been one person, but in my mind, everybody saw me. And so I knew the boss was going to say something. He's going to hear it sooner or later. You know, people like that don't keep that stuff a secret. When you mess up, they like to pass that on for you in case you forget to tell somebody. And so we're driving back, and the boss said, hey, I heard about the other night. Understand the word? I heard. He did not see it. So he's going by what somebody else said. And I didn't ask him what he heard. Like I say, I learned that a long time ago. And so I just admit to it. I says, yeah, you know, that was a bad one. That kind of neutralized them for a second or two, see. And then I came up with my new philosophy. I said, you don't have to worry about that anymore because I'm not drinking anymore. And I went on Larry's way of not drinking for 3.5 years. And I thought I had good sound reasoning for that. One of my coaching duties was to ask the athletes not to drink, and I was a rule enforcer. I had the bar checks, and I went through Kent, a lot of bars in Kent, and the end of joints, and the front door, the back door, the restroom, find out all the hide-and-seek places, same ones I would use, And if I cost you it, it could cost you a scholarship. But I thought, I'll set the standard. Therefore, I can ask you to do that. And if I set the standard, that's a manly way to go about that. And so that was my attitude. It had nothing to do with alcohol, with drinking, with alcoholism. You know, I never heard of AA. I couldn't have found it in the phone book. Was not part of my thinking. Don't ever think it was ever mentioned. So Larry went on his way of not drinking. I was there 3 years, and those of familiar, back in the 70s, we had some shooting and killings and stuff, and didn't drink through that, martial law. And then I changed jobs. I ended up back up in Madison, Wisconsin. And then I got a new setting of people around me, and a new atmosphere, and the new behavior's taking place. And I'm just a new guy on the staff, and I'm included with everything we're doing. And as I look back, there seemed like there was a lot of drinking, a lot of drinking occasion, a lot of boosters this, and outings here, and social, and there was maybe some chasing going on, and big shot in, all that kind of stuff. And I know today I can be influenced. Because I'm there for 6 months. Within 6 months, I'm violating certain principles of marriage sober without taking a drink. I can make errors of living sober. I don't have to be drunk to do it all the time. And then one night we're out at a place, a group of us, and my friend had a drink, and it was a very, very small glass. And I can vividly remember that, see. And he had it sitting beside me. He was up dancing, sweet-talking. And I reached down after 3.5 years without touching alcohol, and when I picked that up, I took a sip. Understand the word. I took a sip of his drink. Just a little taste, just to get to... I don't know whether it's curiosity or what it was. And I know tonight what happened. I didn't know then what was going to take place. But as soon as I took a sip, 3.5 years of no alcohol whatsoever, a taste touched my lips and taste my tongue and into my mouth. And all of a sudden, the alcoholism that was dormant, and I didn't know was there, all of a sudden it just set it to fire. And as I look back, after I got familiar with the doctor's opinion in the big book, I became a living example of that explanation. Where he says in there, there's a group of people that when they take the first drink, after a period of not drinking, they take the first drink. They never define the first drink. They didn't say it had to be a glass of this or a shot of that or a barrel of that. They just said the first drink. And some people, they get what they call a phenomenon of craving. And they give examples for that. And as I look back, I'm one of those people. When I took a sip, my physical system seemed to activate, and I wanted to have more. And that big book says on page 21, I'm on there, says the real alcoholic. Now, I look back, I was alcoholic and didn't know it. A real alcoholic is one that can't control the consumption. To me, that means the amount. Once they take the drink. It doesn't say how much of a drink. It says a drink. A sip, a taste for some. I added that. And I look back sober in the early sobriety, and I fit both those descriptions. All of a sudden, I took a sip, and I wanted to have more, but I got this image as a non-drinker, and you know, I'm always worried about my image, worried about what I think you think about me, whether it's true or not. That doesn't make any sense. What I think you do. And I excused myself that night because I don't want to hurt the image, and I went out to the liquor store, got a supply, and I'm drunk that night. 3.5 years of not touching alcohol. I took a sip, the flame was lit, the fuse was lit, and I'm drunk that night. Wouldn't be any different than taking one of those paper matches, one match, and go ahead and light that match and set the curtains on fire. Maybe it burns down the front of the house. Maybe it burns down the whole house. Maybe it set a fire in half of Colorado's going. I don't know. It didn't take much in my case. And from that time on, I never was able to stop drinking again. I had a lot of events happen. You know, the events of a drunk. Some of us are similar. Some are different. Some are more tragic. Some are less. Some are humor. Some are not. You got your own. That's not what I see as having in common is the behavior after we get drunk. Maybe some similarities. But all of a sudden, my behavior as a drunk caused the boss to call me in after the second season and fire me before the holiday. I've never been fired before. And all of a sudden, I'm out of a job. And when he fires me, I get a strong dislike for him. And because I don't understand that. And then, I had my incidents. I had the DUI, and I was in a small town. And when the chief of police found out, he made arrangements to get that charge changed so that the local newspaper wouldn't blow the story up and embarrass you. And the day I heard about how he got that changed, I got drunk that night. Out of the appreciation for somebody doing me a favor, I got drunk that night. And then the other events that took place in the car wrecks, and finally the wife had enough of this bizarre behavior. And, I'm not working. I'm not getting a job. I got fired 3 times in a row. I finally got to a place in my life where I was unworkable, but we were working down towards that. And I remember one time I was substitute teaching at a little elementary school, and I went over to the residential section, and I parked the car, I went into school, I had some drinks early in the morning, because if I don't have drinks early in the morning, I kind of get sick and I shake a lot. So I wanted to eliminate that, and by about 10 o'clock in the morning, I was starting to feel that come back, so I had a little break. So I dashed out of that school, it's just in a residential section, I got out to my car, I had a little Maverick at the time, a little teeny Ford. And I had the bottle underneath the passenger side in the sack, so nobody knows what it is. And so I get in my car, I dash under my seat, I get that sack out, I'm underneath the dashboard trying to get as much as I can without anybody seeing me, get that back, put that back, then go back into that school and get ready for the next part of the day till noon so I can go do it again. And today that strikes me, that's probably not social drinking. But you'll understand this, it was necessary drinking. If I don't have it, I come apart, not knowing that that's alcoholism and withdrawal. And so I'm having that on a regular basis. And finally, I had another job, and I got drunk while I was on the job. I left the job. I end up the next day waking up. I got a smashed car. I got involved with a double hit and run and all that stuff. And and I don't deal well with those things, see? And I hide the car out, and finally, after a part of a week, I go to get it fixed. No big news on the radio and the TV or the news. And within a half hour, I get a call from a police officer saying I need to come down to the station with a lawyer, and I have to ask him why. I figured it had something to do with the car. And he said, your car was involved with a double hit and run the other day. So I got the lawyer, I came down, and I looked at the report, and I could see that was me. I know that street, that's where I came into work, that's the way I left work early. I banged one on the side, bounced off, hit the one behind him, bounced off, drove into the sunset. Nobody got hurt, just some damages and stuff like that, which, I'm thankful for that today. And cost me points, cost me money, cost me insurance, cost me all that stuff. But that didn't stop me from drinking. Being fired, domestic trouble, going to the nut ward, having a double hit and run, none of those things stopped me from drinking. As a matter of fact, I probably increased the drinking because I got more problems and difficulties in my life. And finally the wife says, enough! And I get drunk one more time on our couch, and she discovers that. And then and some cop comes by with a letter that says, I have to leave. And I say, I'm not going. And he said, yeah, you will. And they left, and he left. And for some reason, I had a shotgun in the back of my trunk. I'd seen a cowboy movie. And I'm not a hunter. I'm not a shooter. I'm not sure I ever loaded one, you know. But it seemed like a thing a guy ought to have, see. And so I grab it and go in the house. I'm going to protect my homestead. See? And nobody come knocking. Nobody come over. And I blow holes in the family room, and I'm trying to create fear in other people and hate in other people and threaten other people, and nobody's paying attention, for crying out loud. The neighbors didn't know it, and then I run out of booze, and I get sober enough to wake up and go, what the hell did I do? I'm not like that. But I was that time. And so I leave and go hide out someplace and apologize, and I wasn't allowed to be over there unless there are two cops there. And good solid drunks, you got to test that once in a while, make sure they mean that. They always meant it. I just took me 3 or 4 times to be convinced that as I look back, you see, I'm on a long losing streak, and I don't know it. I'm losing everything in my life, and my family, my job, my career, my money, the whole deal, and I haven't identified the problem. And I'm fighting as hard as I can fight, and drinking, and I isolate myself in an apartment, and my body blew up like some kind of Buddha, and I'm drinking. I get up in the morning and grab the bottle, step over the barf bucket by the bed. You understand that? You're going to get sick in the night. You don't have to get up to do it. Just, you know, and then into the bathroom, and I'm drinking to make the sickness stop, and drinking to make the shake stop, drinking because just get settled and come back in and sit in my chair. I'm not going anywhere. Got nothing to do, nobody to see. Just getting ready for the day. And then somebody liable to call you up on the phone. The phone would ring. Dude, this priest could have a heart attack with that. So that's before all the messages and stuff. And somebody walked down the hall and you could hear them start. And your heart go faster, faster, faster. They get closer. They go by. Whew, take that drink. That's a condition I was in for a period of time. Total fear, total anxiety, total alcoholic without identifying. And that's what it was like in a general way, guys. And my life changed. What was it like, I had a knock on the door. Uninvited guest. And at this point, when I share this, it's very important to me. So I will try to share it to you with that importance in mind. That I had an uninvited guest come by, down to one person in my life, brought a newspaper, almost never happened, and then left after she checked on me. And I looked at the sports section. Some of us guys were talking about in the kitchen about some sporting stuff. I would look at the sports section first all my life. I did it this morning. And just by chance, understand, just by chance, as I turn that page, there's a picture. Now, you see, I'm already got my morning drink and everything settled, so I'm under the influence, and I'm glancing at a picture, not the headlines or the words. It's on the inside, not the title, not the front page, not the Metro, but the sports section. And I recognize that picture, and he was the first black pitcher for the Brooklyn Dodgers back in the 50s, and it was big-time news in my lifetime, and I knew it right away, and I glanced at his story, and his story talked about how he had lost everything due to his drinking, and how life was better, and there's a number to call for help. I'm sitting by the phone. To this night, I can't tell you what I identified with, but I dialed the number. It was in the Bronx, New York. My kids on one of my anniversary found that copy out of a paper, sent it to me. I have it at home now. I never kept it, and it changed my life. I called the Bronx, New York, and somebody on the other end, out of their wisdom, said something this simple. Sounds like you got a problem. You ought to call somebody local. The world are they going to do for me in the Bronx, New York? I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. Fed it right back to me, and then I had one of those flashbacks. Who do I know that knows anything about this? I'm not even sure what the details were. And I remember I was at a golf outing on one of those fundraiser deals, and I came in off that 18th hole into that clubhouse, and a friend of mine said, Larry, come here, I want you to meet somebody. And I got to meet another baseball celebrity. He says, this is Ryan. And I could have told you that Ryan had been with the Yankees. He was a relief pitcher. He had Coke bottle thick glasses, etc. They always went through the same M.O. on him. And I was meeting a celebrity, and I visited a short time. They weren't drinking. And I left. 3 years later, somebody in Bronx, New York, says, call somebody local. And I remember that introduction. My friend never mentioned baseball. He says, this is Ryan. He's the director of an alcohol rehabilitation center in Stoughton, Wisconsin. That was the introduction that I immediately dismissed. And 3+ years later, that seed had been planted, and all of a sudden it blossomed. And I remembered his name, his location, and his title. And I picked up the phone book, and I called that number, and he was working there. He wasn't in that day. But the lady said, would you talk to somebody else? And I said, yeah. I hadn't talked to anybody else for so long. You know, another guy thing. And a fellow called me by the name of Bill W., Billy Welch. And Billy invited himself over. I know today he did a 12-step call on me. And he came over, and I didn't drink much while he was there, just enough to keep my hands from shaking and stuff. And he told me his story, been a World War II fighter pilot and all that stuff. And he had gotten sober 3 years before at that place, and he recommended it, and he says, "I'll get back to you." And he left. And Ryan talked to him, talked to me, said, "I went in and bring him down here." And so November 11th, like I say, approximately 10 o'clock in the morning, Billy picks me up. I don't know where we're going, don't know why we're going, don't know anything about it, except Ryan said he wanted to see me, and Billy's my taxi. And he drove me down there and in that little farmhouse, and Ryan called me in his office, just about the size of a closet. And Ryan told me some stories about his deal and his alcohol and stuff like that. And he said, "Larry, I'd like to put you in our treatment facility." And I made my first surrender as I look back. I said, "Whatever you want to do." I was done. I had no fight. I had no argument. I had no reasoning. I didn't have the faintest idea what's going on. I'm whipped. I give up. I chickened out. The yellow streak spread. The courage, just whatever term you want to put on that. But he had something in his eyes, and he had something in his voice, and he had something in his mannerism, and there was some kind of a magic in that little closet office. And he walked me across that street and checked me in. And I haven't had a drink since. Once I got through detox and I got to go to their group meetings, it was in a warehouse. It wasn't anything fancy. It was a building beside the hospital with a bunch of crates and boxes and stuff with some table and chairs in the middle. And that's where I found out they talked about this liquid drug alcohol. When you put it in your system, when you drink it, you're no different than that junkie on the street shooting up. The juice gets in, it's got him. When you take it down and drink it, it's got you. And that's what helped Ryan get sober. I'm not debating it one way. That's just what they said. And so when you put it in, it controls you. And then they gave examples. They told the secrets of a drunk to another drunk. And I never heard that before. I'm not about ready to tell you all the disaster and dastardly things I did, because if I tell you, you got the advantage. That's the old way. And they openly talked about stuff, embarrassing stuff and crucial stuff and violent stuff, which allowed me then to take a look at my life. And after going through those meetings and the AA's coming in, I'm sitting in that basement one night. I got a cup of coffee that night. And it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm going through doing my first inventory. You know the one that's right there, right in the front of your brain, just ready to jump out? You're not. We're not always wired real tight, and there's short circuits taking place, lights going on. And I'm by myself. And I'm looking back at the stuff I did, and I see the drinking, the trouble, the troubles and the drinking. I finally start to put them together, and I go back to that one night there in that left guard. I hadn't taken a drink, and all of a sudden I took a drink, I took a sip, and the sip took me. And it just, bam, out I went. I think of Muhammad Ali fighting Sonny Liston. Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. He hit him so quick the cameras, I don't think, got it. I look at booze, that's what they did to me. All of a sudden, he hit me and took me down, and I jumped back into another round, beats me again. I've had a long losing streak. Ryan said one time, he says, if you lose that often in our business, we fire the manager. Who's been in charge of your life, Larry? Me. What's your record? 0-100s? Get out of the driver's seat, get on the passenger side, and let's get somebody over here running your life that knows what's going on. You're like a sober person, an AA person, a sponsor person, a God person, or, whatever it is. But your way's not working. And I admitted to that. That night I found out what was wrong, alcoholism, who was wrong, Larry, and what to do about it equals AA. And I come out of that basement, and I was alert and the hands up, and I want what you guys, I want what those guys in the front of the room have. I don't want what you other patients have. I associated myself with the other patients, because as I remember standing in the hallways, they're playing, "Can you top this drinking stories?" And I'm looking at guys that are losers like me, and they don't have what I want. The guy I want to have something from is that man or lady up in the front that told me what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now, and I like what it sounded like the way it happened now. I want that. And they said, "You can have that if you're willing to do this, 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 and this." And I became willing to do that. And that hadn't changed to this night. And it came time to leave that place, and he said, "Larry, we want you to write down on paper 5 things you're going to do every day." And before you go to bed at night, you check it off, make sure you did that. And I get to pick the five. So if I want to read the good book and the big book and the 12 and 12 and the 24 hour and the reflection and a couple other inspirational things like I did this morning, like I've done almost every morning for over 33 years, that's my choice. And if I want to change it, I can change it. If I want to speed it up or slow it down, I can do that. So when I get to that big book, I do my third step prayer and I personalize that, and then I read 2 pages. I used to read 10 minutes. I used to read a chapter. I've been doing that many, many times. I've reread and read that thing many times. I just change the style sometimes. And I do that 12 and 12 odd and even days. I can figure that out. If I know what day it is, I got a chance to get on the right page. And the 24 hours is easy. It's got the date on the top. So it's a reflection, except for February 29th. My book doesn't have page. Reflection does, and it switches, see. And so my good book is I read the Bible in a year. I've done that since 1980-something. Little Old Testament, little New Testament, little Psalm, little Proverb. That's one of the things I choose to do. Because I had a fear of that God. I remember one time telling Ryan, they were talking about prayer. I have a hard time praying. He said, Larry, I want to tell you something. See, because I get these, thous, and those. I can't impersonate the preacher. He says, you don't have to. What you want to do is you have a God, a loving, forgiving God, and you talk to Him. Use the language you know, the words you know, the way you know it. The key was you talk to Him as a loving friend. And He says, you will be heard. And I found that to be true once I started my prayer of the day the next day. And I've been on and He says, prayer is like communication. Communicating to God of your higher power with your understanding. And I had the right to define that. And they talked about a loving, caring, forgiving God, and that was better than the one I had. It was going to be punishing and burning in hell all my life. And I don't live like that today. Now, when the end's over, He'll make the decision. But I'd rather do it like this than the way I was. In the simplest way. I don't get real detailed. And then the next thing was a meeting guide, and if you're going to continue what you got started, you need to go to the meetings. And I got out of there, and Billy took me to a doubleheader that night, a beginning 12 and 12 and a regular 12 and 12, and he left for Florida, and I went off to the meetings. And I've been going to meetings ever since. I'm a guy that makes a lot of meetings. And if you give me a chance, I'll make as many as I can. And sometimes I have to make half a meeting here and a half a meeting there and a double meeting over here, well, you know, depending with work or stuff. I've never been late to an AA meeting. However, some meetings started before I got there. Legitimately, when you're coming from work or you got stopped by the light or you got a phone call or something like that, I can't control all that. All I know is I'm going to make it if at all possible. Because once I'm here, I'm safe. Once I'm here, I'm with you. Once I'm here, I can absorb the strength and the wisdom, the experience that you guys got. And I come for the whole banquet. I didn't come in here for some fast service recovery. I remember being at Bria Saturday one time. Some guy stood in the doorway. He was in and he was out. He was in and he was out the whole meeting. So that meeting was over, he's gone. I thought, I don't want to make meetings like that. You know, I come for the whole banquet. I want to have the start of it, out of the middle of it, the end of it, and all the dessert. Look at me, you can see that. I use a food example, I'm an illustration of that. If I take a bite, I want more. If I take a puff of something, I want more. When I take a drink of something, I want more. Why would I think today that that's changed because I haven't had a drop of alcohol for a while? I still respect it. And I still fear it, and I don't want it. The closest I know that I've come to alcohol in my mouth was we won a championship, and somebody had cold duck or something in the locker room. They're pouring it over my head, comes down my face, right my nose, outside of my mouth, and I swear to you, I didn't even stick my tongue out. Get a little... Last time I took a sip, I ended up drunk. I'm not doing that again if it's under my power. And I have found the answer called Alcoholics Anonymous. I found the people called members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found where to get that in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Like I say, I've always had a home group, but I've always had many meetings during the week. I've got a men's group on Monday and Friday now. It's the Hair Club discussion that on occasion you need to have seat belts. The room sometimes vibrates. And you bring a topic up, it will be discussed. You may not always like the way it's discussed, but it will be discussed. And I've got a home group, Bria Men's, I like to say it's an open-ending meeting. We don't have an ending time. Some of you will be looking at the clock here soon. say. And those Monday, Friday mornings, you know, we start at approximately 8:30, get done around 10:30, and then we go out and have breakfast till noon. It would take a whole morning for many, many times. We get the whole deal and get the before and get the after. You think about coming like you guys do here. You got that meeting before and the intermixing and all that. We're having the meeting right now, and then afterwards we'll have the after meeting, and some will have to go this way, and some will go over there, and some will be here. I have found that as I watch the ending of a meeting, sometimes it shares with me the quality of, not, I don't want to use the word quality, how the group is made up. If all of a sudden that meeting ends and there's a stampede out the door and they're gone, compared to those, you got a group over here, and you got a group over here. Billy's over there. You got a couple guys over there, and they're doing this. And there's a closeness that's taking place. This is a place of recovery. This is a place, a safe place to be. This is where I learn from your strength, your hope, and your experience. Share it with me. How are you going to share it if I don't hang around with you? Give you a chance. Ask the question. Eavesdrop with you. I found the answers here, so I try to stick close by. And the people I ran with, they indicated they did the same thing. And so all of a sudden, we get those steps, and I looked at the steps very quickly. Step one said, who was wrong, what was wrong? Steps two and three gave me a new relationship with God of my understanding. Not yours, mine. Steps four, five, six, and seven gave me a new relationship with me. Steps eight and nine gave me a new relationship with other people. First him, then me, then others. That's the way it's written, one through. And then 10 is a summary, a current of all that inventory and all that stuff. Get it current. Take care of it today. And I like to end my day, you sit here, try to think of every person in place and event that took place and kind of grade it out. How do we do? And sometimes I fall asleep in the middle of it because if nobody got harmed, there was no darkness to the day. And that step 11 to me is sought through prayer and meditation. Tells us what to do. And I'm trying to get the knowledge of His will. And I said, what's the knowledge of His will? What is something I can remember? Not philosophically. Give me a handle. And I just decided to use our four absolutes. If I can be more loving, more honest, more unselfish, and more pure in thought, word, and deed with the people and places and thing I'm at, if I can do that, I think I'm heading in the right direction. Whether I'm doing it at the right speed or not, that'll take care of itself. That I can understand, not being a deep philosophical thinker. And then step 12, what's it asked to do? Put it in action. You've had your awakening. You've had your personality change sufficient for the recovery from alcoholism as a result of doing the steps. Now try to carry the message. Try to carry the ball. Doggone, get over the goal line. Get in there, make your shot. Get it there and get with somebody. Hand it out to them. Verbally, physically, whatever it takes. Carry that message to somebody else whenever and wherever possible when the opportunity presents itself. That could be at any time, any place during the day. That isn't just at a meeting in my mind. Do I do it at home? Do I do it with my neighbors? Do I do it with my family? Do I do it at work? That's, to me, is what it's all about. I'm a recovering alcoholic from the time I wake up to the time I go to bed, and I don't want to change that. And sooner or later, that topic will come up if we're together for very long. Got nothing to do with anonymity, got nothing to do with tradition, just has to do with the subject of. And I can talk about that subject anytime, any place. And so I try to bring that up whenever possible. And it says practice the principles. What principles? And I look back on that and I think what I saw when I look at my steps is what I heard when I was a kid at home and I went to that church and they said love God, love self, and love others. And those steps have guided me in each one of those areas. Now, whether I can love them enough or appropriate, all that stuff, that depends on where we're at the time. And so I try to love my God, my Creator. And He and I have a talk about that. And we talk about His Son and other people and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden, I have a chance to thank Him for being a sober child of God today, you know. Apologizing for thoughts, words, and deeds that I might be off center. And I ask Him for help to do better. And then I try to have prayer for the people, places, or the people in my life. And then I add names to that: the sick and the suffering and the dying and the lost. And I have my list. Start with my family and branching out. And that communication sometimes takes at least a half hour or more. when time allows. There's a lot of people in my life. I bet there's a lot more people in your life today sober than there ever was as drunk. Starting close and then working out. And just let that recovery just vibrate on out. And I don't know about you, but I like that. I like having a long Christmas card list. I like having nobody on the list that I owe to. Or not very much. I like living like that today. I like the fact that I can go almost anywhere with anybody doing almost doing a whole lot of stuff freely and without guilt, and just go there to enjoy it. Be someplace to enjoy it. I love to go to AA meetings outside the area. When I'm in someplace else, I use a philosophy. As a drunk, if I came in your area, I'd want to know where the joint is. And I get to the joint, and I want to know where the hot spot is. And where's the action? And where's she? And where's he? And all that. And I use the same energy as an AA. I go in area, I'm seeking out AA as hard as I can, be it pre with a computer or a phone call or whatever it is. And a meeting, I collect meeting guys. I got meeting guys from all over. Guys in my home group, when they're not there and they're out of town, when they come back, I ask for the meeting guide. I've got all kinds of them. A friend of mine at dinner tonight said, going to New Orleans. I got meeting guys for New Orleans. I got meeting guys for Paris. I got meeting guys for Ireland. You know, it might be a little bit out of date sometimes, but I got them. And that's just my approach. That's all I'm telling you. I like it that way. My first is where's the AA, and then whatever else we're going to do, you live it up and enjoy it totally and completely. Wow. That allowed me at one time to go to a meeting in North Miami club down there. And I'll finish with this little kind of like a little demonstration. This is what he showed me. I'm not trying to show off. I'm trying to show what somebody did for me that was helpful to me. And I'll try to make myself heard in the back. I was at the North Miami Club. I was at a conference. I took a cab to the club. And the guy met me at the door and said, where are you coming in from? I told him from that hotel over there. He says, you got a ride home? I said, no. He said, we'll take care of it. And he says, listen, I want to talk to you after the meeting. So he started the meeting this way. He says, we got a guy here from Cleveland. He just came to the meeting. He had to have a cab. He said, who's taking him home? And he paused. He wanted action right now. It wasn't like, this guy needs a ride. See you later. And a few hands went up. I have to admit, being single, I picked the prettiest one. She had her friend with her, and she drove a Cadillac. And took me to a meeting that night. So, strictly AA, of course. But at the end of that meeting, he pulled me aside. He had a cup of coffee. And this is what he did that made an impact with me. He said, in this cup, if this is alcohol, and he put it on a desk, and he says, if you put the 12 steps of this program into your life, you will not take a drink. And that sounded like a promise. And his illustration was this. Now, you have to understand, all my life, all my living, has always been visual. I'm a visual person. I watch 11 guys here and 11 guys here and all this movement. And everything I see and the way I learn is visual. I'm not good at the audio. They're terrible at the reading. But you move around and I'll notice your movement. And I'll know right away whether you're left-handed or not, because I want to know if I'm going to have to duck from which side. That's the way it is. But he said, you know, kid, if you only have one step in the program, and he just took a little baby step back, and he reached his arm out, and you could see he could touch the drink. He says, you only got one step in this program in your life, and something bad or good happens. He says, your first reaction is to take that drink. Maybe with two or even three steps. Something bad or good, you're right back there taking a drink, because that's what you've been doing for this period of time. And then he did something that made a difference. He said, if you put the 12 steps of the program in your life, and he paced off 12 steps like one of those officials at our games and stuff, he got 12 steps away, and I can see the distance in there. And he says, now you get something wonderful or something tragic to happen, and you can't just reach out and take that drink. If you're going to take that drink, you've got to take those 12 steps out of there. And that means you got to take those meetings out of there. You got to take those people out. There's a lot of things between me and that drink, and that was his point. And as I looked at that, that makes sense. So I'm about where that guy is right there. I'm in between that, and I can see that distance. And he says, you're either working away from a drink or you're working toward a drink. You can't just tread water for very long. And if you tread, you usually go back. And I'm thinking, well, if I can get 12 steps in there, and if I can add other barriers between that, and maybe I get my 12 traditions, I get my 12 promises, I get my God and my understanding, and I get my sponsorship, and I get my home group in there, and I get my meetings in there, and I get Founders Day in there, and I get the big book in there, and the 12 and 12, and the 24-hour at Stella Maris and Mansfield Prison, etc., etc. All the things that I've been involved with in AA, and a lot of them, were basically because somebody took me and showed me for a period of time and then said, you go do it. And if I've got these things in my life, when all of a sudden the sad stuff, like I mentioned, Marilyn dying, mom dying, dad dying, my daughter with MS, my son going through his deal till he finds it, a lot of stuff happened and a thought of a drink hadn't occurred. And then the beautiful stuff, you know, the weddings and the grandchildren and the championships and all that beautiful stuff. I hadn't had to take a drink to make it more beautiful. If I will, in my mind, if I will keep this program, whatever your definition is, if I'll keep the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from page 1 to page 664, if I'll keep those steps, and I keep those traditions, and I keep those and if I keep those absolutes, and I keep that sponsorship, and I keep that home group, if I'm willing to do that, and I mean do it truly and fully, and apply that to my life and the events of the life and the other people outside the program, then all I can say is my life's been better, and I hope yours is too. Thank you for listening. Lord's Prayer. Join us in Lord's Prayer.